All right, good morning. So today we're going to continue talking about CUDA. And I think today we're really going to start saying, you know, why you need to be a more sophisticated programmer to program the GPU than the CPU. And we're going to start looking at some of the performance characteristics where suddenly, you know, we're going to use more registers and we're going to go slower because we won't have as much parallelism. We're going to start seeing things like that today, which I think that now things really start getting interesting. Just some announcements. So homework one is due anytime today. You know, I said midnight, and that gets confusing as to, well, when is midnight? You know, is that this morning or is it tonight? So just anytime today is fine. Eastern Standard Time. When we did our book on OpenGL that we'll use later this semester, we had a bunch of different authors. They were all over the world, so I told them any time zone is fine. So that pretty much gave them and helped an extra day. But for you guys, we're all in Eastern Standard Time, so it's due anytime today, Eastern Standard Time. One question I wanted to point out in the homework is the very last question here might seem kind of like a give me. You guys cannot read that at all. But I'm sure many of you already answered it. But it basically says, if you were teaching this class, what questions would you ask if you were making this homework assignment? You know, and it asks for five questions of however you want to do it, multiple choice, essay, coding, give me a variety of questions, variety of topics. And to me, this is actually a really important question because a great way to learn stuff is to teach it. You know, you really have to think about it more deeply. And I think that, you know, this is just a great mental exercise. So definitely take this seriously. Don't just, like, go through the slides and write down some slop. And we'll grade it accordingly. All right. And then homework two we're going to release later today. Probably tonight I'll push it out to all your repositories and I'll send an email to the group. And this will be exciting because it actually has coding in it. It has a combination of written questions on CUDA and parallel algorithms, and then also some coding of flocking algorithm, which is kind of like how birds behave. If you've ever seen like a group of birds or just general characters in general, we're going to do GPU accelerated flocking and then some fundamental parallel algorithms all written in CUDA. And then today is the last day to add or drop courses. So, and like I said, you're welcome to sit on the class even if you're not registered. But today is the last day to do so. Okay, so we're going to cover quite a bit of ground today. We'll briefly look at some of the built-in functions and built-in variable types that are in CUDA, and then some of the specifiers we can put on functions. But we're going to put a little bit of focus on synchronizing threads. So we're really going to look a little bit more at the shared memory that we keep talking about and how do we work with it. Then we'll go deeper down into scheduling threads. I mean, we talked about we have a grid, and that has a bunch of blocks, and the blocks have a bunch of threads. But we're going to talk a little bit about more how those threads are scheduled and ran. It was something called a warp. We'll dive a little bit deeper into the memory model that we started looking at last week. And we're going to revisit matrix multiply. We know it has some limitations, the one that we presented last week, and we're going to try to remove those limitations and make it run quite a bit faster. And time permitting, we'll finish up looking at atomic functions, which is ways that you can synchronize the global memory. And I'll try to convince you guys not to do it or to do it sparingly. Okay, so let's look at some of the functional declarations we can do here. So when we write our kernel function, right, we put __ global before the function, and that says that it's executed on the device, the GPU, and it's only callable from the host, the CPU. Now, we can also have device functions, which are functions that we just call from our kernel, you know, because you're not just, right, as your programs get more sophisticated, you're not going to put all your code in one function, right? You're going to break it up into several functions. So you can use __ device to specify that function is a kernel function. And then if you want to, although there's only a few reasons that you'd want to do this, you can also put __ host, __ before your functions to say that, hey, this is a function that only runs on the host. Or you can just remove that, and then that's just a normal C-style function. Some of this gets a little interesting, though. Well, okay, so your kernel function has to return void. When you're going to get data back to the GPU, right, you're going to do so by doing a memory transfer, global memory from the device back to the host. And then all the device functions are inline by default. And the CUDA programming guide, the NVIDIA CUDA C programming guide, you can just Google it. They have lots of good tips. Look, I think our book is great, definitely for general GPU programming, but like for in the trenches, you know, tips from NVIDIA, their programming guide is phenomenal as well. So let me ask you guys a couple questions here. What do you think would happen if I put both the global and the host specifier on a function? You think it'd let me do that? Right, so this is not valid. You can't say that a function is both our kernel function and a function that's going to run on the CPU. But what about this one under it here, where I say a function is both a device function and a host function? You think CUDA would let me do that? You got a 50-50 shot if you guys guess. What if you were making the CUDA runtime? Do you think it would be okay for if someone wanted to say that a function is both a device function and a host function? So what happens is if you say both device and host, this is actually, it's allowed and is actually useful, and you'll wind up with multiple copies of the same function. So that you can have a function that runs on the CPU and a function that runs on the GPU. And one thing that's great about this is a lot of times, and you'll see this in your homework, we'll write something on the CPU so that we can easily debug it and validate it, and then we'll run it on the GPU to get the full performance. But then we can compare our numbers from our CPU implementation to our GPU implementation. So you can do device and host, and you'll know, and you'll get two copies of that function. Now, if you need to know if you're running on a device or the host, there's pound defines that you can check inside that function so you know where you're running. Okay, so as we mentioned last week, when you look at CUDA functions that are running on the device, there's some limitations. We said, for now, with the G80, no recursion, okay? No static variables, right? Why do you guys think there's no statics? So if we had a static, everyone knows what a static variable is, right? So if we had static variables like in a kernel function, you could have multiple kernels, multiple threads right into that static variable, and you'd have to lock, right, to control it. So we have other mechanisms that kind of replace statics in terms of shared memory and then atomics to global memory. And then also in the G80 for now, no malloc. You can't allocate memory in the kernel. We have to know what we're allocating before the kernel. Also, watch out with function calls through pointers. What kind of mistake? Given that we could have both device and host functions in the same app, what kind of problems do you think we could run into with function calls through pointers? Everyone familiar with function pointers? Well, you can have pointers to variables, right? But we could also have pointers to functions, and then you can call that function through that pointer, and that's useful a lot of times where you're calling a function, but you don't necessarily know what function that you're calling. A lot of times you'll see that like when people are trying to do like polymorphism in C, and they don't have virtual functions like they do in C++, you'll see them use function pointers. So here in our CUDA world, we can run into a problem when we have a function, again, on the G80. Once Fermi comes into play, it's pretty much everything I told you this semester is different on the most recent cards. But you can have a function that's on the host, and then what if you have a pointer to that function and you try to call that on the device, right? So you can't do that. So you can run into some issues here, so just be careful if you're going to be using function pointers. And we're going to see similar constraints when we look at the graphics language GLSO. In fact, we're going to see even more constraints in GLSO. And the constraints are part of the reasons why it's fast. Okay, so definitely useful for graphics, but also for image processing or just a lot of different types of simulations. There's built-in vector types in CUDA. And you can see that, you know, anything from char all the way up to doubles and floats. And these are vector types from up to 1 to 4 components, right? Typically we'll be looking at 3 or 4 components that we'll be using. And these are really convenient. We're definitely going to use these also a lot in GLSO when we're doing graphics. These are not built into to C++ or into C, although as graphics people we figure they pretty much might as well be because they're so useful. And there's little constructor functions for you to make these types of objects. So you can say here, for example, make int 2 or make float 4. And then in the arguments to that function are what you're going to initialize the type to. So if you're familiar with C++, just think that these are similar to constructors. And then you can just pull out X, Y, Z, and W components, depending on how many components are in these types. In GLS, though, we're going to see that these can also have like RGBA for color or even texture coordinates. It's really just syntactic sugar. But the X, Y, Z, and W are the first, second, third, and fourth component. So there's also quite a bit of math functions that are useful. And depending on if you're in host or device code, you're either going to get the GPU implementation or you're going to be using the standard C runtime. And then these are overloaded for doubles and floats. Unfortunately, they're not overloaded for all the different vector types. However, there are some NVIDIA utility libraries that have nice functions for the vectors. So all of the math stuff that we're used to is still going to be there. You see square roots, right? Reciprocal square roots, which are really useful in graphics, right? If you're normalizing vectors, all the trig functions, and these are going to be executed using SFUs, which we'll talk about more with the performance. But these are going to use super functional units, which means that you won't get there's not quite as many of them as the regular functional units. You won't get as much parallelism when you use these, but you still get a lot. And thermal is always faster. I mean, you should just assume that it's faster to call these than to try to write something yourself, unless you're doing some like crazy approximation, like the tangent. Like tangent, for example, around zero is like the approximation is like y equals x, like right around zero, right? So and that, if you know that your values are always that close, then you might be able to add some problem domain stuff. To improve the performance. Oh, yeah, so if anyone didn't get slides today, don't be shy, just help yourself and get them. And I'll start, you know, if you guys like me printing out slides, I'll start doing that every class. I'll see how many of them we have left over. Okay, so one thing I think is important to point out here is that sometimes accuracy really matters. So a lot of the work that I do at my company where we have satellite orbits and we have big floating point or big double precision floating point numbers, we really care about accuracy. A lot of times in graphics, as long as it looks right, we really don't care, right? So accuracy sometimes is less important. You know, I always tell some of the guys I work with, you know, fake it till you make it, right? As long as it looks right, it's good. So in CUDA, we do have some math functions that are faster but less accurate. So if you put __ behind, and it's not every math function, but a lot of them, there's also a slower intrinsic one that you can use. So when you're looking to really tune your code, you can consider using these and see if the values you get are still still okay with you. Okay, so that's kind of it for a quick tour of some of the math functions and types that are available to us. Let's take a quick look at reviewing the thread hierarchies because I want to start talking about synchronization. Right, so we said that we kick off a kernel and that code doesn't run on the host but instead it runs on the device. And then the kernel creates a 1 or 2D grid and the grid contains blocks and the blocks are either organized as 1D, 2D, or 3D threads. All right, and then the organization, 1D, 2D, or 3D, totally up to us depending on the problem domain that we're modeling. Okay, then we said the threads in a block, they have access to shared memory that allows them to coordinate. Okay, so here, every kernel will know its thread index, it will know the block index, and it'll also know the dimensions of the block. And we can use these to compute a unique thread ID, because typically a kernel, what it'll do, as we've seen with matrix multiply, it will create some unique thread ID for that instance of the kernel or that particular thread. It will read something from global memory, right, based on that thread ID, do some type of computation, hopefully a very expensive computation, right? Let's do lots of math relative to our global memory reads. And we'd usually write something back out to global memory. And I know you'll see that there's a lot of slides, guys, but I do that on purpose so that this way you see the animation on each separate slide. Like, there's PowerPoint's animation feature where, you know, I could put all this highlighting into one slide, but then I'm not sure what that would look like when it prints. So all the animation that I do on these slides, you'll get, like, one slide per, you know, per animation step. So if you feel, if you look at it and you're like, oh, man, these slides are really thick. We're going to cover a lot of material. It's really because a lot of it is just animation, so please don't be intimidated by that. Okay, so let's talk about synchronizing these threads, right? Because I said threads within a block we can synchronize, and we use this underscore underscore sync threads function. And basically, every thread in a block, once they get to this function, they'll wait until every other thread in their block also gets to this function. And it all has to be the same sync threads call. And then once every single thread gets there, they're all allowed to move on. And what we do with this, the most common thing that we do with this, is we use this to bring things from global memory, slow, hundreds of cycles global memory, into fast, single cycle or a few cycles, shared memory. Okay, and we'll talk about how to declare things for shared memory shortly, but here I just want you to look at these three lines of code. Okay, MD is perhaps a matrix in device memory and global memory. MDS, that's some shared memory. Okay, so I read something from global memory into shared memory. And then we do a sync thread, so that every thread in that block will wait until every other thread gets to that sync thread. Now look at this. This is interesting. I call some function, and I use MDSI and then MDSI plus 1. So why did I put that sync thread there? Go ahead.
Because if it's possible that I plus 1 will not be ready at that point, so you want its value. You want all the values to be ready so that we're ready to sync.
That's exactly right. So what we have here, we have a bunch of threads in the same block, and they're all working together to load things in the shared memory. So one thread will bring something into shared memory, but another thread might want what that first thread brought into shared memory. So they all are going to synchronize here. And this will become more concrete throughout the day. But this is like, you know, I joke and I tell you guys, this is half of the course. This is half of CIS 565. And we're going to look at the other half later today and a couple other halves throughout the semester. But this is definitely a big topic and definitely like a major point in this course. So let me show you a concrete example here. I'm just going to have four threads. Okay, so, and we'll say that we have four threads are on the same block, and we can run two of them at a time. And that's what these two arrows here, they're my instruction pointer or the program counter. So here we have two threads, and they both go and they do device memory into shared memory. And maybe for some strange reason, they're not swapped out instantaneously, because we know that latency is high, but let's just say the scheduler and this GPU is not very good. So then they get down to these sync threads. Okay, so now they're blocked at this barrier. They can't go on because we still have two other threads that are in this block that haven't executed the sync threads. So now the scheduler gets a little smarter and it swaps in these two threads. Okay, and that's on all this scheduling, all on hardware. These do some device to shared memory. And then they get to their sync threads. Okay, so we have four threads in this block total. They've all executed sync threads at this point. So now we know that they've all done their reads from shared memory into device memory, or device memory into shared memory. Now we can go on and we can safely use any of the values in shared memory that we brought in. What do you guys think about that? Is it clear? Hopefully it's pretty. It is pretty simple once you get in there. And it will be pretty obvious when you're developing. I think you'll be like, man, I'm reading from shared memory or from global memory a lot. Let me see if I can use shared memory. And then I think when and where you put these barriers is pretty straightforward. Yes?
So do you also have to sync threads when you're doing the opposite, when you're writing out to global memory?
Writing out to global memory. Sync threads will. Do you ever need sync threads if you're writing to global memory? I would say probably not. Usually, a lot of the output when we do to global memory is we try not to stomp on each other. And if we do have to stomp on each other in global memory, we're going to use atomics, which we're going to cover at the end of today. Other questions about sync threads? So I'm going to argue that it's important that the execution be similar among threads. If we're using sync threads, and what I mean by the execution time be similar, I mean that if there's loops or if there's branches, that they kind of are very coherent thread to thread. So, for example, if there was a loop, one thread doesn't go through the loop once, and then sync threads, and then another goes through the loop 50 times, and then sync threads. They all kind of are moving almost in lockstep. So why do you guys think I think that that's important when using the sync threads? It has nothing to do with correctness. It just has to do about performance. In fact, you could say performance, and that's probably like half credit. Right? So you kind of want to load balance the amount of work that you're doing. If you have a bunch of threads blocked, and then you only have so many more threads to choose from, you might not get the maximum amount of parallelism. So you almost want to kind of round robin these threads as you go down, so that they all kind of reach the barrier at the same time, and they can all move on as quickly as possible. Because when a thread's at a barrier, it can't be ran anymore, right? And the more threads we have, the better off we are in terms of hiding memory or main memory latency. And then the other thing I want to ask is, so why does this only synchronize within a block? Why wouldn't we design sync threads to synchronize across blocks? Because GPU programming would be too easy if we did that. So seriously though, why do we think that we can only synchronize within a block? What does this allow us to do in terms of scheduling the blocks? If the blocks can't synchronize, if blocks can't talk to each other, what does that allow us to do?
Then inherently we can schedule blocks in any order and not have to worry about stuff going up between them.
That's exactly right. I think I probably have all the answers to these questions, like in the future slides. This is the first time I brought printed handouts. But yeah, you're right. If we can schedule blocks in any order, we can really saturate the GPU as best as we can. And different GPUs that have different numbers of cores, we can scale as the number of cores increases, our code will just start running faster and faster. So that's why these things only synchronize within a block. I have that, I think, on the next slide. Yeah, and we saw this slide last week, right? We're on the left-hand side, the GPU, say, only has two processors, can only do two blocks at a time. On the right-hand side, we can do four at a time. And now the code will just scale as a number of, eventually it would stop scaling, but as the number of processors increase, we'll get better performance. Okay, so if you guys, why do you think we could get sync threads to cause a thread to hang? Or do you think we can? Do you think I'm making that up? I said that all threads need to get to sync threads, get to that barrier in order to let the threads continue to move on.
So, I mean, if you had a silly implementation of a while that the number terminates and something else is waiting for that to reach sync, then that other thread is stuck.
Yeah, that's right. That's great. So all threads need to get to sync threads, and if something prevents one or more threads from getting there, none of the threads are going to get past that barrier. Right, so this a while loop would certainly work here, but here's even an if statement, right? If you have threads in the block, some of them return false, not all of them are going to sync threads. This is no good here. Now what about this one? Do you think this could hang? No, you're saying no. So sync threads is per... You need to get to the same exact call, not just any call of sync threads, right? So here we have the same problem that we have here, right? Either if they're all true, we're fine. If they're all false, we're fine. But if there's any combination of that, then we're going to wind up with some threads that are waiting. All right? They're all going to execute as sync threads, but it's not going to be the same one. And matrix multiply, we will see a use case where we need to do sync threads more than once in the same kernel, although it won't be in an if statement like this. Yeah, this is really cool stuff. I mean, this is some of the stuff that when people are like, they're interested in programming the GPU, they're interested in seeing things like this. Okay, so let's move here from synchronizing threads to talking a little bit more about scheduling threads, which we'll say is a complete implementation detail. But in upcoming lectures, we're really going to learn that the more that we know about how threads are scheduled, the faster we can make our code. So I'll almost call it a leaky abstraction in that we really do need to know about it, because when we do the GPU, it's not just about getting something to work, it's about getting something to run quickly. And the more we know about the architecture, the quicker we can make it run. Okay, so what we're looking at here should look somewhat familiar to the diagrams we were looking at in the GPU architecture lecture a few classes back. And this is, we'll say, the first kind of modern GPU. You know, GPUs have went over several iterations, and this here is the NVIDIA GeForce 8, or the G80 that I've been talking a lot about. It came out in late 2006, November 2006, I believe. And this is the first CUDA-capable GPU, and what we're looking at here is what we can think of as 16 processors, where a processor is, can you see my mouse, is a group of eight of these green things. So there's 16 total, each of which has eight functional units, we'll call it at the moment. 16 cores, each with eight functional units. Down here, and then, yeah, I know, as soon as you're looking at this, you're going, well, wait a minute. I actually see two processors grouped together here, right? And then you see this TF. What is TF? Right, so that's texture fetch. These are texture units, and when we do graphics, we're going to look more about these texture fetching, quite a bit, actually, at it. But for now, the main thing that you really just need to look at is we have 16 cores, each of which has eight functional units on it. And we're going to name these cores. We're going to start calling them streaming processors, or SM. And then each individual function, SM, streaming multiprocessor, and I have this on the next slides. And each individual functional unit we're going to call SP, a streaming processor. Now remember, a streaming processor, what you might hear of as a core, right, I think it's much closer to a functional unit or to an ALU than a full beefy CPU core. Okay, so this guy here has 128 SPs, or you might say 128 CUDA cores, right? Much, much different than a CPU core. All right, so that's a lot of info. Let's look at it break down. So here I'm looking at two SMs. Each of the green blocks here is a streaming processor. Eight of them together, streaming multiprocessor. All right, it looks somewhat familiar to what we saw here, where we had a processor that had fetch and decode, eight ALUs, eight SPs, and then the shared context. Okay, so why do we care about this organization? 16 SMs, each with 8 SPs, 128 streaming multiprocessors total. There's some limitations that we need to know about, mostly around the SMs, mostly around the streaming multiprocessors. Each one can host up to 768 threads on the G80. All right, so if we can do up to 168 threads per SM, and we have 16 SMs, we can have up to 12,288 threads in flight at once. Okay, this is where we get the thousands of threads from. They're not all necessarily running, right? But they're all ready. They're all potentially able to be scheduled. So when we say threads in flight, that's different than threads running. Now, a slightly newer architecture, the GT200, has 30 SMs. Each still has 8 SPs. So multiply that out, it's a total of 240 SPs. Now here, the limits go up a little bit. And don't worry about memory. I will never ask you a question where it's like, how many SMs are in the GT200? Or tell me the difference between the maximum number of threads per SM on the GT200 versus the G80. I don't care if you can memorize these. I don't remember. Ask me in the summer if I know these. I might remember them, but I might not, you know. It's not important to me if you memorize these, but it's important to me that you learn how to work with these limitations. And like any question, like you'll see in the upcoming homework, I'll tell you, hey, we have an SM and it can host up to 8 blocks or up to 1,024 threads. But please don't be overwhelmed and feel that you need to memorize these. Like, that will absolutely not. I'd rather you guys spend your time thinking, you know, than just memorizing numbers. But here in the GT 200, each SM is a little more capable in that it can hold up to 1,024 threads in Floyd, as opposed to 768. So here, since we have 30 SMs, and each can host up to 1,024 threads, you're looking at 30,000 threads that this thing can host in Floyd, in Floyd at once. Right, so when we're really trying to utilize a GPU, we need to have tens of thousands of threads. You know, and my buddies, they do a lot of the multi-core programming at my work. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, oh, that's cute. You know, how many threads do you have? 4, 8, 12? You know, I'm like, we have thousands, tens of thousands. You know, they're talking about how parallel their stuff is. But this is where all the power, this is a lot of parallelism here. Okay. So let's talk more about how these threads are actually scheduled, right? So we have threads in a block, but how does a thread from a block get ran, right? So when we did the GPU architecture talk, I started introducing this term warp very early, where I said, oh, these groups of fragments that we're shading, these groups of, or this set of kernels that we're running, they're organized in this thing called a warp, right? So a warp is just a group of threads from the same thread block. With some certain properties that we'll see here. On the G80 and GT200, the warp size is 32. So it's 32 threads. Okay? They're from the same block. They're going to run on the same SM. Because remember, a block is associated to an SM. Right? A block can't be spread across multiple streaming multiprocessors. This is what threads, when you look at scheduling, and I say, oh, this thread is ready to go, this thread is ready to go. We don't actually run an individual thread. We run a warp, so we run 32 threads. And this is going to become really important when we look at the at branches with the branching for performance. The thread index values are consecutive. It's consecutively increasing inside a warp. So a warp might have thread index, or a thread in a warp might have thread index 0, and then the next thread has thread index 1, 2, 3, and so on. Yes? Yes. A block might have, for example, a block might have, say, 512 threads, right? So that is 512 over 32 warps, whatever that is, 15 warps.
So they can switch warps during the actual training?
Exactly. Then we're going to look more at that in the upcoming slides. So remember, warp is theoretically an implementation detail. This is how blocks are broken up and then ran. So here's an example. At the bottom here's a streaming multiprocessor, right? It's got 8 SPs, just like we saw before. And here I'm just also showing the two SFUs where I said that would be doing maybe like the sine and cosine and those types of heavy math functions. But that's not too important here. What's really important is up top, I'm showing three different blocks in three different colors, right? And each block is split up into multiple warps. Now, any warp from any block can be picked for scheduling at any time, right? So anyone that's ready. So there's a priority scheme all done in hardware where any warp can be picked. The same block doesn't always have to run. All that block, for example, all those blocks might have went to global memory, then synced, and then potentially they'll be waiting on global memory or maybe syncing threads. So we can pull in warps from a different block, right? So that really allows us to try to saturate the hardware. So this slide looks familiar, right? So up top here where we see fragment 1 to 8, fragment 9 to 16, think of those are warps, right? And we said warp size is 32, even though they're showing just 8 fragments here. So now we have a warp up in the left-hand side here, the first column. It goes to memory and it's stalled. We bring in another warp right away, right, instantaneously. Next cycle, that other warp is ready to go and starts running. And then maybe that warp goes to global memory. Okay, swap it out, bring in another warp. All right, so this is how we hide going to global memory, the latency of going to global memory. Okay, so on this slide, really look down the bottom here. We're looking at a few different warps from a few different blocks, right? And the blocks are color-coded here. There's three blocks. yellow, blue, and white. And here, we start off from time 1 to 6, and we're executing threads from one block, or one warp, sorry. And then, you know, they stall for some reason. So now, right away, we bring in a warp from a thread block 2, right? That executes for a little bit. That stalls. Now we bring in warps from thread block 3. And now we do two warps from the same block back to back here. And then we can, and then eventually we bring back in different warps and so on. So really the main point here is just remember, warps can come from any block on that SM. And they're swapped right in. Okay, so say we have a warp that's 32 threads, and they're all running, you know, they're all running in lockstep, but then we wind up with this branch. We all remember this slide, right? So if you got to keep those threads running in lockstep and the branch diverges, meaning some go one direction of the branch, some go the other direction of the branch, we wind up executing both sides of the branch and we mask out whichever side we shouldn't have executed at the end. So if you're inside a warp and you have an if statement, and some of the threads go one direction, some go the other direction, we're going to lose performance. Now, a week from today, we're going to talk more about how do we minimize the number of divergent branches inside a warp. It's called warp partitioning. It's very, very cool. Very cool topic. I think you guys will like it. But these are the types of things where I go, oh, you know, the programming CPU is one thing, and the programming GPU is another thing. These are the kind of things that you have to know as to be a good GPU programmer, right? Like this is the difference between getting a 10x performance gain going to the GPU and a 100x performance gain. Okay, so let me ask you some simple questions based on now what we know about warps and blocks and threads. And these are good mental exercises because you're going to have to, like, when you're really trying to crank out performance out of your code, you're going to be thinking about these things. So say I have three blocks, and they're all assigned to a particular streaming multiprocessor, a particular SM. Each block has 256 threads. Right? How many warps is that? I don't need an exact number either. You can just tell me what the math is. You said 3 times 256 over 32? Right. So there's three blocks. Each was 256 threads. So that's 768 threads. Divide that by 32. And the answer is 24. Okay. So on the GT200, we can put 1,024 threads on one SM. How many warps is that? Again, what's the math? I hear someone whisper 1,024 divided by 32. Right? That's it. 32. Oh, if you guys download my, and you're welcome to do that, you're totally welcome to this. If you download the PowerPoint slides, sometimes you'll see I have comments down here that are potentially useful for you. Usually they're more like reminders to me and talking points. But you're certainly, you know, like it's not cheating or anything like that. You absolutely download them and you're welcome to look through those comments. And in fact, a lot of times if you have questions in the slides, the answers may be down here. Yes?
So the sync thread method is working in warps or they can...
Yeah, good, excellent question. So sync threads syncs across the entire block, not just at the, it doesn't sync just a warp. No, the warps are kind of like implicitly synced, I guess you could think of it as. Sync threads goes across an entire block. Is that clear? Are you comfortable with that? Is everyone comfortable with that? That's a good question and it's an important point. All right. So here I was stumped. I welcome being stumped. I like when you guys ask me hard questions. But last spring I was stumped. I had a student go, so there's 32 threads per warp, but you told me on the G80 there's only 8 streaming processors per SM. But you told me that the warp all executes in lockstep. But there's not 32 streaming processors, right? There's only 8 of them. And I told him, I go, yeah, that's great. I don't know. But or the next lecture, of course, I came back with the answer. So what happens here is that when an SM schedules a warp, right, those instructions are ready to go. And on the first cycle, 8 threads enter the SPs. And then on cycles 2, 3, and 4, you get 8 more threads each time. So it takes 4 cycles to dispatch a warp, right? Because you got 8 eight SPs and 32 threads. So you're going to need 4 cycles to punch through it.
So is that almost reminiscent of
pipelining? It's similar. Yeah, it's similar to pipelining. Now, the thing here, and this is a question, this is a good question too. I believe some instructions will finish after these 4 cycles. If it's like, you know, if it's a very simple add or something like that, that's all in registers. After the 4 cycles, that warp could be done, right? But if these are going into like the SFUs, like the functional units, those themselves are pipelined and could have more instructions. I don't know all the details to that, although I may, if people are interested, I may look more into that so you guys know. But in the simplistic view, especially for the next question I want to ask, you can assume that 4 cycles these things dispatch and are executed for very simple instructions. So, given this knowledge, let's go through a little exercise here. Whereas, say a kernel has 1 global memory read, okay, and I'm going to say it takes 200 cycles to get that memory back. But immediately after that global memory read, I have 4 non-dependent multiply adds, and a multiply add that's a fused MAD, they even will call it, or fused multiply add. That is all. That is one instruction, and that's multiply add is always built into the GPU because it's so useful. Okay, so I want to think about how many warps are required to hide this memory latency. Because what's going to happen is we're going to go to memory, we have some code to execute, and then maybe we have some other warps that have some code that can be executed. But how many warps would we need so that we never, or so that we always have work to do? We're not stalled on this memory read. All right, so here's how we think about it. You know, each warp has 4 multiply adds. So in our view, we're going to say that's 16 cycles. That's 4 times 4. That's 4 instructions. Each instruction will take 4 times to 4 cycles to get through. Now, to cover 200 cycles, if we take 200 divided by 16, we'll need the ceiling number. We'll need 13 warps in order to have enough work so that memory read is completely drowned out. And these are also remember, these instructions I said are non-dependent on the global memory read. And we're going to see tricks where we're going to try to put a lot of computation. We're going to read from global memory, and we're going to try to put a lot of compute between the global memory read and then when we finally use the memory. Right, definitely we've been doing that in graphics for years, and that's even relevant here in the general purpose world. All right, let's go back. Let's look at the memory model in a little bit more detail than we did last week. And then what we're going to do is we're going to combine our knowledge of the memory model, our knowledge of sync threads, our knowledge of blocking in general, and we're going to make matrix multiply scream, okay? Because the one that we did last week was great and all, and it was parallel, but it really does not utilize the GPU. Okay, so let's go back over these. We'll start with the registers, okay? Each thread has a set of registers that's only visible to that thread, right? These things are fast, read-write, and it basically, if you say, like, you know, float F or int I, it's a register, okay? It's as simple as that in your code. Now, there's only so many registers that are available to us per SN, right? So if we increase the number of registers that we use, we're actually going to decrease the number of threads that can be ran. And let me show you an example. So again, G80, for a particular SM, it can host up to 768 threads, okay? And it has 8K registers. And a register is 4, it can hold up to 4 bytes. Yeah, 4 bytes, so it can hold like a float. So if you were to work out the math about how many registers per thread do you think that allows? Or just tell me the division. Right, it's 8K over 768, right, which is, I want to say 10. Yes, 10. It'll allow 10 registers per thread. That's not very much, right? I mean, think of like the type of code that we write. 10 registers is nothing, right? Here's the problem. As our car gets more complicated, we're going to want to use more registers, right? More variables. But as we start to use more on the G80, use more than 10 registers per thread, we start to reduce the number of blocks that can be run on any particular SM. Okay, an entire block, not just a thread. So to make this concrete, let me show you this example here. What if we jumped up and we had each thread use 11 registers, okay, and our block size was 256 threads? Well, we used to be able to host 3 blocks, okay? 3 times 256 is 768 threads. We used to have 3 blocks on this SM, but now that each thread jumped up the number of registers and we exceeded the register limit, we can now only host 2 blocks, which is now only 512 threads. Okay, so by having more complicated kernels, we've reduced the number of threads or blocks and blocks that we can host on a particular SM. Okay, so now if we only have 2 blocks with 256 threads each, it's 512 threads, we only have 512 divided by 32, 15 warps. 15 warps that can be scheduled on that. So if we have less warps because we're using more registers, how does that affect us? How does it affect performance?
Well, it means that we're going to actually see stalls occur.
Yeah. Our ability to hide memory latency decreases. If we have less warps to schedule, we have less ability to hide memory latency. Right? And this is a performance cliff. All right? And we'll briefly talk more about this in our performance section. But here, when I bumped up the number of registers, and now I went from having 768 threads down to 512 threads, right? That wasn't a linear drop-off. That was like, bang, that's an issue. This, you'll see this happen. Your kernel will get like a little bit more complicated, and then bang, performance goes way down. And then you're on the forum. What's going on? Why is my code all messed up? So now, this sometimes you can actually add more registers, and it allows you to improve performance, and we'll talk about that. So this is like a double-edged sword, too. There's no like hard and fast rules here. One question I want to ask, though, is we say that when we go above this register limit, we have to reduce by the block. Why do we have to remove an entire block? Why couldn't we remove just individual warps? So if you removed individual warps, could I go schedule them on another streaming multiprocessor? Could I put them on another SM? Why do you say no?
Because each block is to run
up. Right. Why? Because I said so?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, partial credit. So, right, each block needs to run on the same SM because each block can coordinate with sync threads and shared memory. Right, so if you had warps from 2 different blocks on 2 different SMs, they don't have shared memory anymore. You see? So they have no choice here, but when you go above usage limits, that they have to reduce by the block. What questions do you guys have? You will have questions when you start coding this.
I had a question, but I couldn't answer that before.
Okay, see me. If you have homework questions, see me after class. Definitely.
I was saying, this was a
homework question?
Yeah.
Very good, then. Here's the answer. Go ahead. Come to class, get all the answers. So in general, homework questions, for all, email me, I'm reasonably responsive, but, my office hours are right after this class, so just grab me after class, and we can talk too at any time for homework. Varun is definitely better to go to for CUDA programming. for general course concepts or graphic stuff, definitely come to me. I mean, Vern knows it as well, though. Okay, so the memory here back. So we looked at registers, right? We said there's something called local memory, and I said that local memory is a little misnamed on the G80 because it's actually global memory, except the visibility is only per thread, right? And there's a copy of it per it's in global memory, but there's a unique spot for each particular thread. And if you use arrays, for the most part, they're going to be in local memory, right? So be careful with using them. Now, of course, there's limitations here where if the access is only done with constant indices, then the compiler can determine that and put it elsewhere. So as time goes on, as architectures go on, these things get more lax too. Like this is G80. Okay, so I got nothing more to say about shared memory until we talk about banking. But we all know it's fast. It's multiple threads that are in the same block can use it to coordinate. We will look at bank conflicts, though. That can slow it down a little bit. So we can have up to 8 blocks on an SM. That's a hard limit on the G80, or 768 threads. But we only have 16 kilobytes of shared memory, right? That's not very much shared memory. We said that we have 8K registers, and we have up to 16 kilobytes of shared memory. So if we can host up to 8 blocks, right, how many kilobytes per block can we have? 2, right? 16 over 2, so 2K per block. Now, if we go over this limit, we wind up with the same kind of reduction that we would have with when we go over the register limit, right? So if we have blocks that each use 5 kilobytes of shared memory, how many blocks could we put on a particular SM? 16 over 5 is 3 and change, right? So we could only host 3 blocks because each one of them is using 5 kilobytes of shared memory. So now we see the same thing. If we use more shared memory, we're going to have less total blocks or less total warps to use for scheduling. Okay, so global memory, like we said, it's big and slow, right? Hundreds of cycles to get to it. Any thread can get to it. There is a performance hit if you're doing truly random access. To get the best bandwidth, you want your reads to be coherent, right? And the same thing is true in a GPU. We have CPU. We have best cache performance. The bandwidth, though, is considered pretty good, right? In this peak, the G80 is 86.4 gigabytes per second. GT200 is 150, and we'll see a lot of memory, right? The GT200 has 4 gigs of memory on it. We just got a Tesla card that has 6 gigs. Of memory, right? Which is, that's an incredible amount. I mean, my laptop only has like 2 gigs of system memory, I think. So we're starting to see a lot of memory going on these guys, which is also great for us as developers because now, before we might have to come up with tiling algorithms from the CPU to the GPU, where, oh, we only have so much GPU memory, so we have to invoke this kernel multiple times on different sets of data, where now we can just do it in one push. Okay, and then there's also constant memory, right, which is read-only from all the threads. It's in global memory, but if you have coherent access where all the threads are reading from the same location, it's going to be very fast, and it's going to be brought into local caches. But there's a limited amount of memory there, 64K. And then there's CUDA functions, just like the mem copies that we saw before, that can be used to access constant memory. Okay, so just to kind of summarize the memory model and drive this home, if you look at automatic variables, or just variables that you declare, float, that sort of thing, they're going to go in a register, right? The scope is that one thread, and the lifetime is the entire kernel, right? Now the arrays, that's going to go into local memory, right? In most cases, and again, the scope is just the thread. Only one thread can see it. Lifetime's the kernel. Shared memory. Right, that's going to go into shared memory on the SM. And everyone sees here that the scope here is the entire block. So when a block uses shared memory, any thread in that block can see any part of that shared memory. And we declare shared memory simply using the __shared__ keyword. And then for global memory, right? That has scope of the entire grid. So when you do that kernel invocation, anyone can read from global memory there. And the lifetime is the entire application. Same deal for constant memory. All right. So what questions? I know that it's kind of a lot to take in here, but in terms of the memory model here, you know, registers, shared memory important, global memory important. I mean, what questions do you guys have about these? Okay, so like I said, there's some mem copies that we can do for constant memory. You know, they're very similar to the ones that we use for global memory. Just know that they're there, and you know, look them up if you need to use them. They're not hard to use. So what I want to do is, given our knowledge now of shared memory, of sync threads, of blocking, let's look at matrix multiply. Okay, so here is our CPU implementation. We had two square matrices coming in, M and N, and then we output a matrix P, where every element in P is a dot product of a column of N and a row of M, right? And then we saw on the CPU implementation, we had to do a double for loop where we go over all the elements in P and then do that dot product. But we observed for the CPU implementation that we can get rid of those two outer loops and let the GPU schedule all those threads. All right, and then here is our CUDA implementation. Right, so we're dealing with 2D matrices, so we're using 2D thread indexes. Each kernel is going to do one dot product, right? Because the main observation was this is a data parallel algorithm where all the dot products can happen independently. And then, remember, two outer for loops are gone. Right? These are the same slides from last week. Two outer for loops are gone because that's implicit when we invoke the kernel. We don't need to lock or synchronize anything because this is all right now global memory. Right, reading from global memory, writing to global memory. But we observed some problems here. We said, we're only using one block, right? When you go back here, I'm only using the thread index. There's no block index, no block dimensions. Right, so we only got one block, and each block only have up to 512 threads. Right, so that's very small matrices that we can support. If you take the square root of 512. And it's all global memory. Right? There's barely any compute, a bunch of global memory read. So let's remove the size limitation. Let's be able to do really big matrices, right? And as I'm sure you guys can guess, all we're going to do is break everything up into tiles, right? And then we're going to have a block per tile. So here, by the way, tiling comes from, like, if you have a bathroom and the wall is tiled, you know, where there's tiles on the floor, that's why people come up with the idea of tiling. So we're going to need both thread index and block index to index into a given tile. And you'll see here, for this particular example, we broke this into 3x3 tiles. So you can see the block index is 0, 1, 2 for in the x direction, and then in the y direction, same thing, 0, 1, 2. And then each tile has a given size, right? Width by height here. So here we go. Here's a matrix is 4x4, and we said tile width is 2. So therefore, the block size is 2x2, right? So each block is also 2x2 in this case. And then just like before, when we go to compute the dot product for any element, we're going to do one column and one row from the input matrices. Okay, so let's look at the code. Now, look how we're using block ID and thread index ID. So when you use block ID to jump into that particular tile by skipping over all the previous columns or rows from the other tiles here. And tile width, by the way, could also be replaced with block dimension. That's a built-in keyword, blocked in dot x or blocked in dot y, which in this case are the same. So we do this for the columns and the rows. Then the code's exactly the same. The actual compute is exactly the same. All we did was change our indexing. And a lot of times we're going to see that. And this is a good implementation strategy when you're going to start to get things working. Like, don't, even though you know, hey, I'm going to need multiple blocks, I'm going to need shared memory, and I'm going to need all these other techniques, start with just putting it in one block. Get your code working, and then split it across multiple blocks, and then add shared memory, just like we're building up this example, right? Because, I mean, I can't stress more, not just in GPU programming, but like in all your development, you know, early and often. Get something working early, keep it working often, you know, and always test it, just iterate one step at a time. And one of the keys to doing that is to have like really fast tools, right? The CUDA compiler in Visual Studio is pretty fast. But you can imagine if you had like a build time that was like 15 minutes. And I know people who tell me that they have build times that are 15 minutes. Then your ability to iterate like becomes like impossible. But thankfully in our app and in our technology and the size of our apps here, we can build really quickly. So I encourage you guys to build, to code these one step at a time and test it every single time. Okay, so now you'll see when we invoke the tiled kernel that we no longer just have one block. We have multiple blocks, and we take the entire width and height of the matrix, and we'll assume it divides evenly by our tile size, and that's how we determine how many blocks we're going to need, the grid size. Okay, so we've solved half the problem here, right? And everyone sees it's a pretty simple transformation from one block to multiple blocks. But we can do really big matrices, but our performance still isn't great because we're going to global memory. In fact, so they say for the G80, the peak gigaflops is 346.5. Which is actually kind of low, because this is an older card, where the newer cards are going to be the teraflops. But for the matrix multiply example, if we were to work out all the math, we need 1,386 gigabytes per second of bandwidth in order to keep that compute happy. But the G80 bandwidth is much less than that, right? It only has 86.4 gigabytes. So this winds up really limiting our code, right? So here, we're only getting 21.6 gigaflops instead of the peak 346.5. This slide is probably useful for one of your homework questions, by the way, although you certainly don't need this slide. And then in practice, things can actually run a little bit slower. But we really need to dramatically reduce going to global memory in order to get anywhere near the maximum gigaflops that this card can get, right? So let's observe some things about this, about our matrix multiply here. When we do these dot products, let's just look at a given column of the output matrix. Do you guys see that to do this dot product, it's all reading the same column from the input matrix, right? Same deal for rows from the input matrix. So we're actually reading the same spot from global memory over and over again. So we could use shared memory to bring some of that in. It would be a lot faster. So what we wind up doing is we break all the kernels into phases, where a thread is going to pull in. It's not going to do the entire dot product in one shot. It's going to bring in a subset of memory into shared memory, like one tile worth of one tile from both, say, M and N. It's going to do a part of a dot product, and then it's going to bring in another tile from both M and N, do another part of a dot product, and so on and so forth. Let's see, I said that. So this is the most code I would ever put on one slide. I know it's a lot of code, but this is the entire implementation here. The first thing I want you guys to see is that we've declared two shared arrays, okay? These are for the M and N inputs, and these are in shared memory. Okay, that's with the S suffix, which is totally optional. It's not required by CUDA. It's just a naming convention used by our book. We have two shared arrays, M and N. Okay. Now look at this. Look at the for loop here to do our dot product. We actually added a for loop outside of our inner loop. So what you see here, which I think is a good observation, is that we're going to make our code run faster, but we're going to add more code, right? So hopefully you guys know less code isn't necessarily always faster, okay? We're actually adding more code. We're adding what looks like more work, but overall we're going to see a dramatic performance improvement. But here in this outer for loop, this is each phase of the algorithm. We're going to go tile by tile, right? So for the one example that we saw for that 4x4, that example matrix that was 4x4, we broke it into 2x2 tiles. So here this loop would go twice. Now what we do is each thread here brings in one element from the M and N input tiles. Okay, so they're all going to bring in a tile, one element from the tile from both M and N. And they're all going to sync. So now we have those two. Like, let me jump back some slides. So here, say on the first iteration, they're all going to bring in the memory for the blue tile from both N and N. They're going to bring in all that memory in the shared memory. They're going to sync. Everyone's going to get there. They get all that memory in shared memory. Now we do the dot product, but look, it's just K less than tile width. We're only doing a subset of the dot product using what we have in shared memory. Then we're going to sync threads, and we're going to go to the next iteration of our loop. We're going to bring in a new tile in the shared memory, do a subset of the dot product, and so on. Now tell me, why do I have this second sync threads here? Okay, tell me what happens. We go through this outer for loop. We go through it once, okay, we read two tiles in the shared memory, do a subset of the dot product. Now, when we go right now, we go through the second iteration of this loop and we start reading in the shared memory again. Why do we need this sync threads? What would happen if I took the sync threads out, okay, and some threads were doing their dot product in the first iteration of this loop, while other threads we're writing to shared memory in the second iteration.
Well, it's in the first iteration of the loop that starts spitting out incorrect values, since they start being values from some shared memory along in the second.
Yes. You see, what would happen is in the first iteration, these guys are doing their dot product, they're reading from shared memory, but other threads are in the second iteration of that loop might be writing to that same shared memory that they're reading from. So therefore, you need to put in the second set of sync threads before we write to it. Now, in the very last iteration of this loop, do we need the sync threads at the bottom?
No.
No, why not? Because there's nothing to sync, right? At that point, we're not going to write the shared memory. We're just going to bounce out, and we're going to write to global memory at the end of our answer. Now, we are not syncing anything when we write to global memory, right? Because we don't have to. It's all independent. Everyone is writing to a different location. What do you guys think? You guys comfortable? Right? It's pretty cool.
It's a lot more complicated,
but yes. Well, you know, like I said, I really think that it takes a more sophisticated developer to write on the GPU than to write on the CPU. Now, granted, I'm not saying that GPU programmers in general are smarter than CPU programmers. I'm certainly not saying that at all. But to really take advantage of the GPU for what you want to use it for, which is performance, you need to know quite a bit about it. Okay, so one thing that I haven't answered here was how do we pick tile width, right? How big are our blocks? Certainly we can pick it to be too large because we're limited by the number of threads we can put in a block. Right? And again, that's either 512 or 1024 depending on the architecture. So right there, we can only make tile width so big. And then there's also shared memory. Let's look at how much shared memory we're using, right? So we said that we have up to 16 kilobytes of shared memory per SM, right? And we can host at most 8 blocks, right? That's 2 kilobytes per block. We need 1 kilobyte for each input matrix, N and M. So that's, we need 2 kilobytes total, right? So if you make that tile width too big, you're going to wind up with less blocks being able to be scheduled. So the way this works out is that we can reduce global memory by basically the access of tile width. So for the 16 by 16 tiles that they showed here, we're reducing global memory access by a factor of 16. Now look at the numbers that they show here. We're almost getting full utilization here. Jeez, what is it? Yep. Yes?
Can you also have the opposite problem of, for this it would be if your tile width was too small, but I guess generally it would just be defined in a way that creates like so many blocks.
Having too many blocks too many blocks to execute?
Yeah.
Is there a limit to the... I want to say that there's some big limit, yeah. There is some limit to the number of total blocks you can have. I want to say 64K. It's like some really big number. I would have to look that up. But there's a bigger problem to having really small block sizes. What is that? Or really small tile width. What is that?
I mean, if you have a tile width of like 1,
then you kind of... Yeah, we've already... But what about 2? What if it was 2 by 2? You're going to wind up with a lot more global memory access if the tile size is...
It sort of depends on how large the actual matrix
is. Yeah, absolutely. It does. Now, I will tell you, if the matrix is like 4x4 or something really small, I mean, don't even waste your time with the GPU, right? Like, just do it on the CPU, right? Because you have to transfer data to the GPU, you have to transfer it back, right? But for large matrices, this also, by the way, is for dense. What we're looking at here is for dense matrices, which means there's not a lot of zeros in it. Because if there's a lot of zeros, we would use different techniques here. Well, by doing this tiling and the shared memory here, we're really getting very close to the peak gigaflops that we can expect from these GPUs.
So in general, you want to maximize the size of the tile, right?
Yes. For this example, yes. Yes. In general, that's not a bad approach either. But you got to watch, because if you start using more shared memory, you're going to wind up with less total blocks, you know. And you'll see where you guys will do your projects or you do your homework, and you'll make a graph and you'll go tile size 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and you'll see where the performance curve is. In fact, we have a great homework assignment that is all performance metrics like that. Let's see. Pretty much covered all that. So, all right, we have 5 minutes left. So I'm going to cover atomics quickly. Because that way we'll be on. Because I want to make sure that we cover parallel algorithms and some performance stuff in the coming lectures, so you guys have everything you need to do your next homework. And atomics is pretty short here. So I know you guys, we have shared memory, and within a block we can use sync threads and we can coordinate with shared threads, right? But someone's going to come to me for their project and go, Patrick, I need threads to communicate with each other. They're not in the same block. You need to let me know how to do that. We need to do this. And I'm going to tell you not to. But no, you don't understand. You have to do it. I'm going to say, okay, fine, do it, but only do it the least amount that you need to. Why would I say that?
Because since you can't share information...
Right. So if you're synchronizing, you know, inner block between blocks, you're going to be using global memory, and it's going to be slow. And you're also really going to hurt the total amount of parallelism that you have here, especially because now you have different blocks. Used to be able to be scheduled in any order. Well, now they kind of can be, but if you have a lot, they still can be. But if you have a lot of them going to the same part of global memory and they're all locking, you're really going to slow things down. But just to get us positioned for thinking about this. Say I have an unsigned int, I initialize it to 0, and I have 8 threads, and they all increment all incremented, right? I don't know what count's going to be. All those threads could be in the same warp, and count could be one, right? Because they all do read, modify, write. And you don't know what order read, modify, write happens. Or count could be eight, but they all happen separately. So this is not an atomic operation here. We don't know what the result of this is. But we do have atomic functions that we can use to access global memory and know that it is atomic, meaning that no one else is going to interrupt that operation. You have no idea what order it's going to happen in. You don't know which thread is going to execute which atomic operation first, but you know that when you do it, that it's going to be non-interrupted. And this is not on the G80, by the way. It's on most of the more recent cards, though. Any card today that you would buy absolutely has it. So CUDA will give us something that's, for example, we'll just look at atomic add, or say we just want to add a value to an integer. And here, we just call this function. We give it the address of our variable, and we say, here, add one to it, and it will add one for us. What I really want to know from you guys, and that's it, and there's a bunch of atomic functions, and you just call them, and you give it a pointer to device memory. You call it a day. They're easy to use. But what we care about is, I mean, how would you implement them? How are these implemented? Right, so here we're looking at atomic add, right? We're giving it an address to something in device memory, and we're giving it a value that we're going to add to it. So this is like, you know, star address plus equals value. Right, so I'm just going to make up keywords because this is my PowerPoint programming language. So one thing is I could just do a lock, right? You guys have seen locks before. And I can lock, have some, you know, it can be a fine grain or a coarse grain lock, but I lock and then I increment and I'm done. This code doesn't compile, not only because I introduced the lock keyword, but because I just found an error here where you see how it's inval and I have plus equals value. So you can change that as you see fit. You can make them both val or value. I'm surprised I didn't catch that last semester. But the way this is actually implemented in CUDA is without locking, what we have is we have an atomic function that's an atomic compare and swap, where we get a value, we get a pointer, and then we compare that pointer, we dereference that pointer, compare it to some known value, and if it's the same, we assign a new value, and we return the old one. And this is like an intrinsic. This is an atomic operation that's given to us. How many people have heard of atomic compare and swap? You guys? Because it was pretty new. Geez, like 8 years ago, this was like new. You know? But now, atomic compare and swap, I think, is pretty pretty well. Yes?
But doesn't that function use locking?
So my implementation uses locking.
Yeah.
At the actual instruction level, I'm not quite sure. We're going to assume that we're giving this very quick intrinsic. What it does under the hood, I don't know. My implementation uses my fake lock. Okay, so here's my implementation here, where I get the old value, I dereference our pointer and get the old value. And then I say, if the value that's in that point that thing points to is the compare value, then I assign our new value to it. Otherwise, I don't assign anything to it, or I'm just assigning the old one here to make it concise. So this is a compare and swap operation. And since I'm out of time, we're going to stop here, and you can think about what these functions return, what these assign the address and what these return. So on Wednesday, we'll finish the atomics. There's only a couple more minutes. And then we're going to go into some general parallel algorithms.